This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of February 12th, here are a few top stories. In the news, let's recap now on the big issues at the Arizona legislature this week. Here's KJZZ Steve Goldstein and Mark Brody.
Gerrymandering and redistricting have been a part of electoral politics in the U.S. for generations, and their power to influence who controls the House and Senate are even more in the spotlight now. The Supreme Court is considering cases that would affect how two states, Wisconsin and Maryland, draw their district lines. And Pennsylvania is moving forward with a redraw thanks to a decision by its state Supreme Court. The GOP's ability to dominate the House in recent cycles has a lot to do with a redistricting strategy that was hatched nearly a decade ago. David Daley has written about that in a new piece for Salon called How the Republicans Rigged Congress, and he's here with me to discuss it. David, let's begin with one very important name from this process that a lot of people don't know, Thomas Hoffler. How did he make a lot of this possible for GOP candidates?
Thomas Hoffler and Chris Jankowski are two of the most important Republican political thinkers of this era whose name no one knows. And together, they strategized and came up with the idea that explains so much of our current political reality. In 2008, in 2009, Jankowski and Hoffler are trying to plot the Republicans' road back to power. And what they realize is that 2010 could be a hugely consequential year because it's a redistricting year. Every 10 years after the census, we redraw every state legislative and congressional map in the country. What they realize is that because it's state legislatures that play the dominant role in drawing not only their own lines, but also the congressional lines, that if Republicans are able to take over key state legislatures in blue states, in purple states, in 2010, that they would have the power to draw the maps that define the field of play throughout the entire decade.
Maybe the technology and the access to data has been so much more prevalent now. Is this something that either party could have tried in a previous cycle and just weren't aware or didn't understand quite the power of what we're talking about?
There's been gerrymandering for as long as there's been politicians in this country. As long as there have been politicians, they want to have the power to draw their own lines, to make their race a little bit easier for themselves or their party, or to make it harder for the other side. That's nothing new. But I think what you're saying is exactly right. In 2010, there's this confluence of political intent, but also technology and advances in computer software and computer speed and in the availability of these massive data sets that make it possible to draw lines that endure for a decade. There's a big case going on right now in Pennsylvania where the state Supreme Court has invalidated all of the congressional maps in Pennsylvania as being an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander, and they're forcing them all to be redrawn. Well, in 2000, Republicans also had the power to draw those maps. And by 2006 and 2008, when the political situation had changed in the country, when political favor turned against the Iraq War or after the economic crash in 2008, Democrats were able to take 12 of the 19 seats in Pennsylvania in those years, despite the gerrymander. They were able to overcome the power of the lines. The gerrymander that the Republicans draw in Pennsylvania in 2011 is so strong that this entire decade, in 2012, 14, and 16, Republicans have held 13 of the 18 seats in Pennsylvania, even in years when Democrats have gotten more votes. So Democrats might get 51-52% of the vote. They only get 28% of the seats. So the technology between 2000 and 2010 is of such a difference. I mean, think of the way we texted in 2000 versus how we text in 2010. It has completely changed, and it makes it possible to draw really stout and durable district lines.
And David, considering we've all seen the generic polling that says, okay, because not only do midterms usually turn out poorly for the party of the president, it's also because, you know, many people are up in arms because of President Trump and that administration. But based on what you've said and based on how these districts have been drawn, can Democrats actually afford to be optimistic about this, or is it really that hard to flip so many of these seats because of what you've talked about, because of how these districts have been drawn based on this Republican strategy?
It's going to be really interesting to see whether a blue wave is capable of overcoming this red firewall. We have a pretty good indication of what happened from Virginia last fall, where Democratic candidates got 225,000 more votes than Republican candidates for the House of Delegates there in Virginia. And yet Republicans, thanks to the lines that they drew and the gerrymander there, were still able to keep control of the House of Delegates 51-49. In Alabama, where Doug Jones wins statewide for the special election for the U.S. Senate, Roy Moore actually won 6 of the 7 congressional districts, if you break it down that way, in Alabama. So Republicans have a huge structural advantage going into 2018. In 2012, Democratic candidates for the U.S. House won 1.4 million more votes nationally, and Republicans were able to maintain a 234-201 advantage in the chamber.
What kind of battle should we expect in 2020 with certain states and what they're planning to do? I mean, we're going to see just a bloodbath on both sides where both parties are saying they're not going to give an inch on this because they realize what can be done.
I think that's right. The Democrats fell asleep on this in 2010. They simply didn't see this Republican strategy coming, and they have been paying the price for their political ineptitude for the course of this entire decade. They are better organized this time around. Eric Holder and Barack Obama have been running something called the National Democratic Redistricting Commission, and they are focused on trying to run a similar play as the Republicans. What I fear is that suddenly there's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars going into all of these state legislative races. It's going to turn our politics nastier and more brutish all the way down to the local level. We have to find reforms that have the power to actually take this out of the hands of politicians and put it into the hands of the people again.
David Daley is the author of Rat Eft, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count, also the recent Salon piece, How the Republicans Rigged Congress. Dave, thanks very much for the time.
A pleasure. Thank you.
From the Fronteras Desk, young people brought to the U.S. against their will have been at the center of the debates over immigration reform this year. Some have described the back-and-forth pull of the fight between Democrats, Republicans, and President Donald Trump as exhausting. They're not waiting for the decision to be made for them, neither here nor in Mexico. In the first part of this special report, we begin in Arizona, where so-called Dreamers are taking their future into their own hands. From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk in Phoenix, Matthew Casey reports.
Lorenzo Santillan hooks his food trailer to his truck. The father of two is running on just 3 hours sleep, and it's already been a busy morning. First, he worked on his generator that powers the food trailer. Then he ran to the store for ingredients. Now he has to get the trailer to downtown Phoenix for the lunchtime business crowd.
My business is ni de aquí ni de allá. We serve authentic Mexican food.
Santillan is in the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, or DACA, and there's a link between his immigration status and his company's name.
It stands for neither here nor there.
Meaning that Santillan doesn't consider himself to be from Mexico or Arizona, even though he's lived here since he was a baby and has no idea what life is like south of the border.
The way I see it is I travel to Mexico through the food.
The prospects of long-term success for Santillan's business are blurred by the uncertainty of what's to come. So he's doing what his parents did 30 years ago, looking north.
My solution is moving to Canada.
Arizona stands to lose a lot if Santillan leaves and others follow. Analysts at New American Economy say Arizonans eligible for the DACA program made a combined $438 million in 2015, and they paid $66 million in taxes.
Why do I need to be in a country that doesn't accept me?
Marisol Federal Credit Union does accept immigrants like Santillan. It's offered DACA application loans and helped recipients open their first bank accounts. But habits have changed since the Trump administration announced plans to end the DACA program. CEO Robin Romano says so-called Dreamers have stopped making long-term financial decisions.
They're starting to pay things off, and they're starting to go back to cash.
DACA recipients have not been closing their accounts, Romano says. But switching to paper money is a sign of someone taking their finances underground.
The reasons for that seem to be pretty clear, that they are scared about what's going to happen to them in the future.
With his food trailer parked, Santillan and his hired help get to work preparing today's menu. Cooking wasn't Santillan's first career choice. He was on the team of local high school students who beat MIT in a robotics competition. It's an underdog story so good that someone played him in a movie. But Arizona law against in-state tuition for undocumented people kept Santillan from becoming an engineer.
All I want to do is succeed.
Hi.
Hi. Victoria?
Yes.
Victoria Cruz is a loan officer with Fairway Independent Mortgage Corporation. She's worked with DACA recipients in California and Arizona.
I personally have noticed that the market's gotten quieter. I think there's fear out in the market.
Cruz says some clients wrongly assume their DACA status is a deal breaker, or that her office will contact immigration authorities. She's also worked with successful DACA recipients who wanted to buy homes for their parents.
You're not seeing them reach out as much as they were reaching out at one time.
Your quesadilla is ready.
Thank you.
Here you go, thank you. Here's some salsas.
Perfect.
Santillan grins as he serves a folded tortilla oozing cheese and meat. His DACA permit won't expire until 2019, but he says there's an 80% chance he'll move himself and his business to Canada this year, as long as he can do it legally.
I don't feel like it's fair what's happening, so I mean, I can sit here and cry about it or just do something about it.
Santillan admits he doesn't know where to settle in Canada or how to cope with winter after living in the desert all his life. Still, he's optimistic.
Maybe Canada's going to accept me even more. Maybe I'm going to have more success because there's not a lot of Mexican food out there.
Santillan wants to become a U.S. citizen. He'd gladly stay near his family and kids if leaders can strike a deal. But in the meantime, he's preparing like they won't. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And you can find the second part of this special report at kjzz.org. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. For a little something different from KJZZ's original production, here's the show's Steve Goldstein.
And now for a tiny desert concert. That's when we bring local Arizona bands into the KJZZ studios to play a couple of songs for us and talk a bit about the music. For this month, we hear from Flamenco Por La Vida. This is not your typical band. Rather, the group is made up of a singer, a guitarist, and a flamenco dancer. Founded by Angelina Ramirez, the group is dedicated to bringing the heart and soul of flamenco to the valley. I started by asking Ramirez about flamenco's essence, what it is, and what she does differently.
Yeah, that's an awesome and loaded question. Flamenco is quite complex, and there's a lot of theories about when it started and where it came from. And traditionally, growing up as a student of flamenco and a dancer on the dancer's perspective, I made sure that I studied the music. I just kind of generally knew, for lack of a better term, the rules, you know, of how I interact with the guitarist, how the guitarist interacts with me, and how the singer, and how we kind of all work together to create what we create. And usually it's all improvised. We, for many years, tried to practice a lot of the traditional, what we call puro flamenco. But just recently, we decided to start kind of telling more of our stories in flamenco, which our conceptual show is a little contemporary for such a historic art form. But that's where, even in Spain and all around the world, flamenco keeps evolving.
How does the storytelling you mentioned, how does that manifest itself on stage? Because I'm less familiar with a flamenco performance that involves vocals. I'm used to seeing a couple or three dancers with a guitarist, a traditional percussionist. So how is this different?
We have to remember that the singing is what came first. So it was the words, the storytelling. Flamenco was usually a form of expression of the oppressed, the poor and the oppressed. So that's why when you see flamenco and maybe you're not familiar, why are they so angry? What are they crying about? There's like the llanto, the ay, ay, ays, you know, and that's all just about our pain. Flamenco is so adaptable to everybody because it's a tool to tell our stories, you know, whether if they're sad or they're happy.
So Angelina, why don't you tell us what you're going to perform next and give us some of the background on it.
We are going to do a bulerías. Bulerías is kind of a more festive, one of the most fastest rhythms out there. Usually performed in casual settings. It's also usually a time where people kind of take turns, like a breakdance circle. So people take turns from the cante to dancing. The guitarist will put their guitar down and have at it at the dancing. So it's more festive and party-like. And so we're going to do some bolerias for you.
Mentioned your team before. What does it feel to be in sync with this particular team? Because with a traditional band, you've got the rhythm section, you've got the guitarist, maybe you've got a vocalist. But with this, with the different elements of the physical aspect of the dancing with a guitarist, with a vocalist. How does that work together in sync?
There are sounds that I have to listen to in the singer, sounds that I have to listen to in the guitarist when they're taking the lead in one of, like, a section as a someone supporting in palmas, in hand clapping. It's not just clack, 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 clack. You know, there's also a structure to that. We have to listen to where the music is taking it, where it's going. Are they going to take a break? Are they going to end an idea? And that goes same with the baile, the dancing. So there are movements and calls that the singer and the guitarist and the cajon player and the bass player, whoever you have, your violinist, your pianist, you know, that have to listen for so they can roll with you. And if they don't, you might get an angry dancer or an angry singer, you know, because there's nothing worse than trying to get to an idea and somebody pulls the brakes on you. But accidents also happen. And when that happens, and if you're with a group that, okay, there was a little bit of a hiccup, if you will. Okay, let's try that again, or let's take it somewhere else. So sometimes it doesn't work, you know, but when you're with a group, a team that you feel really solid with, and with artists that really kind of know the structure and the language behind flamenco, then, you know, you can get a piece that lasts like half an hour. You won't get anyone to stop.
And Angelina, before you leave, why don't you give us another performance and tell us about this one too.
Sure. We're going to perform an Alegrías, which is from Cádiz, Spain. If you ever go to Cádiz, everything is the beaches, the sand is white, the water is blue. Everyone from Cádiz is a little bit more happier. So this one's a medium tempoed rhythm, a little bit more lighter and happy, and just kind of starts to build and build and build up to very celebratory at the end.
Turn now to the science desk. We all know Hoover Dam, and you might know about the Imperial or other dams that managed the Colorado River. The very first completed dam on the Colorado was the Laguna Dam. It diverted water to farm fields in the Yuma Valley. As KJZZ's Brett Jaspers reports in our Untold Arizona series, the Laguna Dam set the table for large-scale farming in southwest Arizona.
This story about a dam starts with fire. A steak fry in Yuma. It's where I met Jim Cumming.
Medium rare. Bobby, I need a medium rare. Yep, there you go.
All right.
Perfect.
Cumming is a retired farmer, third generation. He's also the president of the Yuma County Water Users Association. His grandfather immigrated to the U.S. from Ireland by way of Canada. Cumming's grandfather got 160 acres in the Yuma Valley from the federal government.
They had to develop that land, grub it out, you know, bring it into the production, and he had to make a living some way, and this Laguna Dam project opened up, so they moved up to the dam, and he worked on the dam there as a carpenter.
Cumming's grandfather helped build the dam that made it possible to irrigate his own farmland. The Cumming Farm and so many others have thrived due to the Laguna Dam and later Colorado River projects.
It's created a tremendous amount of wealth in the community and the state and the nation. I mean, we send produce now all over the United States, Canada, and even ship it overseas.
On a sunny January afternoon, workers at the Laguna Dam were repairing the original concrete from over 100 years ago. The agency, now known as the Bureau of Reclamation, built the dam. It cost $2 million.
Because it's historical, we have to maintain it.
Doug Cox works for the Imperial Irrigation District. It manages the Laguna Dam. The dam has gates along the California side that are now sealed up. Back when the dam was still used for large-scale irrigation, they'd release the water out of those gates.
It used to divert the water into a channel, and the channel ran all the way, and that's how Yuma got their water.
So irrigation was happening, but the Laguna Dam is small and not built to store water. Crops could still be wrecked by floods.
This didn't really stop the flooding because it didn't stop the water. This is not a storage dam, it's a diversion dam.
Colorado River flooding didn't get fully under control until the Hoover Dam started storing water in 1935. These days, the Laguna Dam doesn't do much more than divert overflow after a big rain. But the Laguna was the first step in harnessing the Colorado River to create both safety and prosperity.
It's up there probably about 20 miles upriver.
Tina Clark is a historian for the city of Yuma. We're on the roof of the old city hall.
I think the Laguna Dam is reflective of having the West become domesticated more and more.
Construction wrapped up on the Laguna Dam in 1909, the same year the Yuma Territorial Prison closed. Coincidentally, Clark owns a restored church in Yuma, built in 1909.
The domestication really came with the churches and bringing your wife and becoming a farmer. So the Wild West pioneers, the miners, the guys that came alone versus the guys that brought their wives.
The farming life drew Jim Cumming's grandparents to the Yuma Valley. Dams, starting with the Laguna, allowed his family to thrive there.
And the river wasn't that, you know, it wasn't stable at all. It was a meandering all over, so it made it real tough, and that's why the Bureau of Reclamation created these places, and it's been a godsend down here.
It's hard to argue with him when you visit Yuma at harvest time, passing acres and acres of winter vegetables. Fields as green as the surrounding hills are dry. Brett Jaspers, KJZZ News, Yuma.
Thanks for listening to KJZZ. This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. From the Business Desk, an old kitty litter mine in Yavapai County could become active again. And yes, it was actual kitty litter. Now that material is sought after as a valuable additive to concrete, but some locals are unhappy to have a mine as a neighbor. As part of our Untold Arizona series, KJZZ's Casey Kuhn reports on the changing values of a town built from the mining industry.
Listen to how this rock sounds.
There.
Hear what geologist Al Birch says is a little tink sound when his rock hammer hits the soft white stone.
You can tell when you hit it with a hammer, there's a little tink to it. That's how you tell the silica content.
This pearly rock's special sound comes from the high amount of silica or glass inside it.
It's very unique because it has just the right chemical composition and just the right physical characteristics to be able to be used as a high-quality natural pozzolan.
Pozzolan is a silica-rich substance used to strengthen concrete. The high grade of this particular mineral puts it in the same mining category as gold, but really more along the lines of something like high-quality limestone. This material is not metallic, it's just valuable and uncommon. To get to the mine site, Birch, Bureau of Land Management officials, and I pile into a car in Skull Valley, 40 minutes southwest of Prescott. The SUV drives slowly up a dusty road flanked by jagged white stone spires.
The white cliffs and the hillsides is the volcanic tuff material.
BLM Hassayampa field manager Rem Halls explains why this mine could happen on federal land.
One of the reasons that we're considering this at all is because of the demonstrated economic value of the material.
The plan is the ivory rock crunching under our feet will be mined and crushed for under $20 a ton, then sold to buyers for around $50 to $60 a ton. And this project would last decades. Kirkland Mining Project Manager Birch says using the land for its resources follows in the footsteps of Skull Valley's mining past.
So there's a long history of mining in the region. And that's what really led to the discovery and the use of this deposit through time.
Skull Valley's name comes after white settlers found the sun-bleached remains of a large Native American battle left in the area. Settlers carved out the rock to build their homes in the 19th century. Those stone blocks even made it all the way to build part of Arizona's Capitol building in Phoenix.
Four horses here.
Skull Valley resident Allison Dixon has her home by the railroad, where she keeps a small peach orchard, chicken coop, and her prized Arabian horses.
If you live in Yavapai County, you live near an old mine, for sure.
Dixon is anti-mine. She says if the mine were on private property, she might feel differently. But she thinks the potential 85 trucks a day the mine could bring through this pastoral area are just one of the many downsides.
It is private interests looking to profit off of public lands, and in doing so, negatively impact the local community and destroy a beautiful environment.
This is a shift in attitude from economic development to human habitation in Skull Valley. Brigitte Pleitgen lives with her husband in a home right next to the public land and the mine claim.
We moved here for peace and quiet. We didn't move here to mine. Nobody was mining here when we bought. We were told nobody was going to mine here.
Pleitgen can see the white dust blow off the disturbed rock from her kitchen window, and she knows every rocky crag and outcrop of land she's hiked on for the past 20 years.
But now this, scraping this all open, is now creating the issue of having dust. This is new. They just dug all this up.
Pleitgen points out the spot where the mining company has taken 1,000 tons of rock for sampling and processing. To her, the land is worth more than the economic value that can be derived from it. At the top of the mine, BLM field manager Rem Halls says officials are listening to the community.
If this project is to go forward, we want to make sure we mitigate any or all impacts that have been identified.
Things like biological and cultural resources and air and water quality. If all goes according to plan for the mining company, operations will start in the spring of 2019. Casey Kuhn, KJZZ News, reporting from Skull Valley.
And finally, in education news, here's the show's Mark Brody.
Hundreds of parents, teachers, students, and community members rallied before the Scottsdale Unified School District Governing Board meeting last night. At the meeting, Superintendent Denise Birdwell announced another top administrator, one she hired, would not be coming back. KJZZ's Mariana Dale has been following the issues in the district and was at last night's rally and governing board meeting. She's here now. Mariana, good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
So you were at the meeting last night, as I said. What was it like outside?
So I counted at least 250 people at one point. There was definitely more. People kept arriving as the meeting started at 5. It's one of the largest protests I've seen at a school board meeting in quite some time. You got your typical rally stuff. People are making signs, wearing pins and stickers in support of the local teachers union. For the most part, it was peaceful. There was some chanting. A popular one was Bye Bye Birdie in reference to Superintendent Denise Birdwell. People calling for her resignation, for a shift in leadership, but also really wanting to show support for teachers. You even had some students there holding signs saying, I love my teachers. And there were a lot of honks of support from people driving by.
So how did school officials and the governing board respond to all that?
Before the governing board meeting, the board president, Barbara Perlberg, issued a statement saying that the board respects the community's right to gather and was ready to hear their concerns. Inside the meeting, which was standing room only, they actually funneled people into an overflow room. They didn't really acknowledge what was happening outside. There was kind of a vague reference the superintendent made to issues that might not seem positive, but no one really said directly, you know, there are all these people outside, they're upset, and here's what we're doing about it.
Now, Superintendent Birdwell also announced a pretty big staffing change. Chief Operations Officer Lewis Hartwell will not look to renew his contract. Did she say why?
So let's go ahead and just listen to her exact comment she made announcing his resignation.
Today we received from Mr. Hartwell that he will not seek renewal of his contract, and as of June 30th, he will no longer be with the district. And I appreciate the work that he's done.
Lewis Hartwell was one of the top hires Birdwell made when she started in the district. Community members have been raising concerns about Birdwell's connection to Hartwell since last year. The Arizona Republic, who's also been reporting on this, described Hartwell as the brother of Birdwell's landlady and someone that had also worked with her in the Higley School District where she was before she started in Scottsdale. Likely, the next steps are going to be the hiring of an interim COO and then going through the typical hiring process to get someone new in that position.
So, Mariana, do you have a sense for how all of this is affecting teachers and students in the district?
So, members of the teachers union were pretty prominent in the rally outside. They expressed being really frustrated. They want transparency and a sense of respect from the governing board and the administration that oversees them. And frankly, all these investigations about possible corruption, misspending of public money, is really distracting from their usual job, which is to educate students. We also did hear from some students at Scottsdale Unified School District Schools. One young woman spoke up during the call to the audience in the actual governing board meeting. Her name's Jory Weiss, and she's a junior at Chaparral High School.
The atmosphere of my learning environment has been altered from a positive and encouraging one to a strict environment where auditing student compliance with trivial rules is considered more important than educating in a meaningful, profound way.
She called the campus oppressive and unsettling and said she felt like her teachers were afraid to speak out, which is why she took it upon herself to speak up at the governing board meeting.
So do we have a sense of what's next in all of this?
Mark, we're going to keep following the story. The attorney general has yet to share his final report, but I really want to emphasize that we can't tell these stories without the voices of the people who live, go to school, and work in the Scottsdale Unified School District. So I'd really like to invite anyone that has a story to share or has a question, something they want to know about what's happening, please get in touch with us.
All right. That's KJZZ's Mariana Dill. Mariana, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Mark.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Vitalist Health Foundation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.